BCFM 93.2.
Their goal is revenge for the persecution of men of intellect and science throughout the Middle and Dark Ages by the church, by the kings and queens, by the governments, and by the ignorant mob. That's why they want to destroy all existing governments, destroy all existing religions, and put the shackles on the mob.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. First, Egypt, where the elected president faces a death sentence. Now, Kiev and Ukraine, where Yanukovych is a wanted man. Who was it that overturned democracy in Ukraine? Was it pro-NATO armed gangs? And will Russian President Vladimir Putin be taking it lying down? The battle for Ukraine began in earnest last Friday when the Kiev Parliament building was occupied by armed men. The ruling party of the regions, the MPs, were shot at and forced out, leaving a rump of right-wing pro-EU MPs who then voted to impeach President Yanukovych. Now, Russian troops are carrying out scheduled exercises on the Ukrainian border, and other groups of militias and armed men are popping up all over Ukraine. Martin Summers will take us to Ukraine on his weekly tour of Global Flashpoints in a minute. And also, food additives, one very good reason to check the label tonight, as we look at a sweetener neurosurgeons call a poison that's in much of our food, called aspartame. And the media, as a media battle rages to explain the inexcusable, that's to mark the anniversary of the First World War outbreak, Martin Summers will take us through former BBC Newsnight economics editor Paul Mason's four-part series that could not, in his opinion, that's Paul Mason's opinion, be produced in Britain today. The People's First World War. Tonight we look at part two, The Slaughter. And it's the 20th anniversary this week of the death of the Texas-born comedian Bill Hicks. Some believe he was bumped off just as he was about to get his own network TV show over in the US. And we celebrate his memory by hearing why he might have been such a danger to the US establishment. But we start this week with Ukraine, Martin. And last Friday was quite an important day, wasn't it?
Well, yes. The situation obviously is developing as we speak. The real danger, of course, is that you're now, in a pre-war situation, a la, the Slovenian revolt against Yugoslavia in 1991.
Just tell us what happened there and how it compares, then.
Well, it's the same. When you've got a situation where people are not resolving a political crisis through political means, but are using military force, then you're on a slippery slope.
Yeah, but Yanukovych, although he was democratically elected, he wasn't popular, was he? With massive demonstrations in the streets.
Yes, but of course his main support isn't in Kiev in the West Ukraine, it's in the East Ukraine in the Donbass, where he's from, and in Crimea. So in other words, it's like if people of London besieged Parliament and demanded something, but in actual fact the rest of the country doesn't really support them, which was a common problem in the French Revolution, for example. Of the crowds in Paris were very revolutionary and wanted to kill the king, etc., but the peasants out there in the country were not so sure. And in general, the Western policy in general used to be that, elections are elections and protests are protests, but protesters can't demand that the government go.
We keep hearing on the news here about the impeachment of Yanukovych. He's a wanted man. But these resolutions have been passed through a parliament where the ruling party has actually been removed from their seats.
Well, I'm not quite sure of the detail of this, but I think it is quite insignificant that it's a bit like the beginning of the English Civil War, isn't it, where the royalist members of parliament withdrew from the parliament or were kicked out, and a new junta took over representing the parliamentary forces. But the real problem in Ukraine is that you've got a split between the Ukraine was, as a country, has only made the shape it was now in 1954, because I just read recently that the Crimea, for example, was not historically part of Ukraine and was put into the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic in 1954. And in any case, the Ukraine itself was only created as a state in 1945 by large chunks of what had previously been Poland being included in it. So in other words, when you talk about a country and whether people are representative, the government's representative, the question is, does that country exist? And, you know, like, does the UK exist? And as some people will be saying, down with Ukrainia, and some people will be saying, down with Ukrainia. And we have similar problems in this country, don't we?
Well,
Northern Ireland, Scotland, etc.
A lot of the problems seemed to start last week, Wednesday and Thursday, when scores of both police and demonstrators were killed as guns managed to find their way into what had up until then been a relatively peaceful protest. At least certainly there weren't armed gangs hanging around. And on Friday morning last week, on BBC Radio 5 Live, there was quite an interesting reporter by the name of Marco Boyson. So let's have a listen to what Marco Boyson then had to say about the sniper rifles which were being used to kill demonstrators in the streets of Kiev.
There was a report yesterday in the most reputable Kiev newspaper, Zatkolo Nedeli, that the snipers who are shooting at the demonstrators with high-velocity rifles are using rifles that were manufactured in Britain. And I can't verify that report, but I think it's incumbent on the British government to find out whether there are rifles being exported to the Secret Service of Ukraine from Britain that are being used against the protesters.
Thank you both. Marco Boyson, who is a Ukraine expert at New York University in London.
Victoria Derbyshire there from the BBC, just ending that report from Marco Boyson from New York University in London. Martin, is this normal for Britain to be exporting these sniper rifles? We're told they were AVK type sniper rifles, which were then used to kill demonstrators.
It's very normal. I mean, Britain basically is one of the biggest arms exporters in the world, and as long as the government is a legitimate government, which the Yanukovych government was until the day before yesterday, then of course they can buy weaponry from Britain for their security forces, and we will happily sell it to them. The real question in my mind is who armed the demonstrators and where did they get their weapons and possibly weapons training from, and were Western intelligence services in any way involved in that, directly or indirectly, as they have been in Syria? Because it could well be that Britain is arming terrorists around the world. Oh, did I say that? Well, we've been doing it for years, so why are we surprised? And I'm not just talking about over-the-counter sales to police forces.
What about these militias that are now popping up right across? I mean, effectively, the demonstrators in Kiev city centre formed themselves into a militia of some sort to take over the parliament building Friday night. So these militias exist. I mean, they're popping up now. Over in Sevastopol and other places.
Yeah.
Where is this likely to lead? Because no one is admitting who's actually controlling these. Who might be controlling them?
Well, I mean, the different militias will have different strings being pulled by different people. But the real danger, as I pointed out in my book, which came out in 1998, was that Ukraine becomes the new Yugoslavia.
Just remind us of the title of that book, Mark.
The book's called Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle. And it was co-authored by myself, Martin Summers, and Laszlo Andor, who's a Hungarian, who is currently a European Commissioner for Growth and Jobs. Incidentally, the Hungarian government is supporting the Russian government on this, which is rather unusual.
OK. Why did you make that comparison then between the Balkans and the
happened in Yugoslavia, which was one country, but of course, is it one country? Is it five countries? Is it seven countries? It's a real question. There were massive differences culturally and economically in Yugoslavia. So you had some very poor parts of the country, mainly in the south, particularly Kosovo, and in Slovenia at the other end was a relatively prosperous place, not dissimilar to Austria over the border. And trying to keep all of these different ethnic communities and with different levels of economic development in one structure was very difficult. And you've got similar tension in the Ukraine because the IMF have now arrived in Kiev and they're going to give a credit to the new government, but they have to carry out reforms. Now, what those reforms mean is that everybody who works in heavy industry in the Donbass is going to have to be kicked out of their jobs and it's all going to have to be privatised. They're not going to like that. And the way to avoid that, from their point of view, is to declare independence from Kiev. Because don't forget that this country Ukraine was only created by Stalin in 1945. It's got no real basis. And that's why if you push and say, well, we're going to force our way and have our people running Ukraine, whichever side it is, Russian or European side, the other side aren't going to be happy and the potential for a civil war grows up. Simply, where do you draw the line? You could say, well, let's just have two countries, you know. But the problem is, where do you draw the line? And it's a bit like drawing the line of the six counties in Northern Ireland. Where do you draw the line? Through the middle of this farm? Down this road? It's not quite clear. And of course, the militias, as in Yugoslavia, will fight to determine where that line is. And that's the danger.
Now, we've already heard that there are Russian troops massing on the border doing some sort of apparently pre-scheduled exercise, if you believe that, on the eastern borders of Ukraine. Now, I mean, are we looking at a scenario here where the Russians will be bringing their own troops up to the eastern border of Ukraine, the NATO forces bringing their troops up to the western borders of Ukraine, and then fighting it out within using sponsored militias from both sides? Is that
pretty? Yeah, that's pretty much what
I'm thinking. And possibly looking at the individual regional administration buildings as a kind of key place to take over.
Yeah, well, the far-right Svoboda Party seized the administration building in Lviv in the west of Ukraine and declared independence of Kiev. But, of course, the counter-manoeuvre to that is the people in the east Ukraine declaring independence from Kiev in their turn. And you could say, well, let's just have a divorce, like Scotland and England might have a divorce. But the problem is there's no agreed border between these two communities. So who's going to get what?
No, we're hearing today, this is BBC News, just less than an hour ago, the ex-leader Viktor Yanukovych is vowing to fight back. He's given a press conference today in Russia, saying that he was not overthrown, but was compelled to leave Ukraine under threats to his life. I mean, that Victoria Derbyshire programme we heard there confirmed that they were chanting death to Yanukovych. There were people there saying that on that particular programme. And the latest flare-up, according to the BBC, Ukraine has accused Russian troops of seizing two airports in the Crimea. These charges have been denied by Moscow, and Russian President Vladimir Putin's called for a rapid return to normality.
Well, what really complicates the situation in the Crimea is that the Crimea was only placed as part of the Ukraine by by Brezhnev in 1954. The original inhabitants of the Ukraine were Crimean Tatars, in other words, of Muslim origin. They'd conquered it, you know, centuries previously, and they were all deported by Stalin in the 40s for collaborating supposedly with the Germans, and then they only came back at the end of the war. So they are pro-Ukrainian. In other words, they're pro-Kiev. Whereas the majority of the population, about 60%, are Russian-speaking and are pro-Moscow. And, of course, the Crimea in particular is the flashpoint because, A, it wasn't in the Ukraine in the first place. It's only put in the Ukraine by the Soviet government. And, secondly, this is where the Russians have got their Black Sea Fleet, which is the people that faced the West off in the Eastern Mediterranean over Syria earlier last year. And so from the Russian point of view, that's an absolutely crucial geopolitical pawn that they can't afford to lose. So the potential for conflict here, as happened in Yugoslavia, between two different coalitions of forces, is definitely there.
I intend to continue to struggle for the future of Ukraine against terror and fear, Mr. Yanukovych said today in the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don. What's going on now is lawlessness, lack of authority and terror. Decisions in parliament were taken under duress. He apologised to the Ukrainian people for not having enough strength to keep stability and described his usurpers as young neo-fascists. Now, I noticed that Seamus Milne a few weeks ago in The Guardian was saying that actually there's quite a strong far-right fascist element to what was the demonstrators in Kiev, now presumably in charge.
Well, there are also more moderate demonstrators, so let's try and keep a sense of balance. But yes, there are right-wing forces in the Ukraine who openly celebrate the support of Ukrainian nationalists for the Germans in the 1940s. And, of course, that's red rag to a Russian bull. So the potential for a lot of antagonism here is very high. And, of course, the Crimean Tatars were also accused of being pro-German, whether that was true or not. So you've got, just as in Yugoslavia, you've got all those dead ghosts of probably, if you think about the Ukraine, that probably was the battleground of World War II. probably more people died in Ukraine. It was more awful as the German army surges across the Ukraine and then were driven back through it with the ordinary people just caught up in it. That was the nub of World War II, the worst bit of it. So all of that history is there to be resurrected if people are stupid enough to do so.
Well, I mean, it was particularly bad, wasn't it? But for Russian prisoners of war, I mean, the Nazis really did not look after them at all. I think I'm right in saying something like 3.5 million Russian prisoners of war were starved to death or tortured to death, etc. They weren't kept in prison camps and fed, that sort of thing.
No, I mean, the point is that this ought to be resolved politically. I don't know if it will be, because it's become a zero-sum game between the West and the East. And in actual fact, the danger of a conflict here with people... I mean, people have already died, but a lot more people dying is definitely there. I mean, what will happen is what happened in Bosnia, is that certain parts of the country will be controlled by Western forces and certain parts will be controlled by Eastern forces, and there will be a front line. And if the hatred is enough, then they'll start massacring civilians as they did in Bosnia.
But it seems to me there's a bit of game playing going on here. Both sides, the Russians and NATO, both pretending that events have been spontaneous, when actually there's been actually quite a lot of geostrategic influence going on.
It would be difficult to make all of these political things line up in Ukraine, but in actual fact they've done quite a good job. In my book in 1998, I predicted exactly this kind of crisis, and I expected it to come quite quickly. So in a way, I'm amazed that it's taken 16 years for it to happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because Ukrainians found a fantastic skill for compromise. They really did just bumble along and manage to hold it all together, largely because they didn't bring in the IMF, they didn't go in for shock therapy. They knew it would cause... You see, a lot of underlying all of this is the economic failure of the Ukraine. Its post-Soviet history has been disastrous. A small minority of oligarchs have taken all of the wealth of the collective wealth of the country, and everybody else has been left with nothing, which then leads them to be very receptive to whatever nutcase is screaming in their ear.
In other developments, this BBC report is saying Swiss and Austrian authorities have blocked the assets of Viktor Yanukovych and his associates and launched a corruption probe. Russian MPs have proposed new laws that would make it easier for Russia to incorporate parts of Ukraine. And amid fears of hyperinflation, you mentioned this earlier, Martin, yeah, Ukraine's central bank has put a 1,000 euro, it's the Ukrainian currency is a hryvnia, Hryvnia, which I find almost impossible to pronounce. So we'll call it 1,000 euros or £820 limit on daily cash withdrawals. And the UN Security Council is set to hold a private discussions on the crisis today.
Yes, well, I mean, the underlying economic crisis in Ukraine is partly to do with the political crisis, but also to do with the quantitative easing taper in the US, the emerging markets. And it's not just Ukraine. You've got Venezuela, Thailand, Argentina, Turkey, all of these countries are going into political crisis. And you're getting a situation where you've got democracy on paper, but the divisions within countries are so great that people can't accept losing an election.
Well, I remember Thursday last week, Yanukovych agreed to a May election, which, I mean, he was originally saying it was going to be the end of this year, December election. Yeah. Then he was negotiated down to say there's going to be a general election in Ukraine in May. The next thing we hear, Parliament's been stormed, democracy is gone, surely.
That's why the Russians are annoyed, because from their point of view, they're saying, look, they were pushing Yanukovych to call the opposition to join the government. Let's form a government of national unity. Basically what we've done in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Although that's been somewhat in question this week. But if one lot say, well, we're not having that, we want all or nothing, then it creates a situation where the other side are going to say, right, it's all or nothing then. And at that point, there isn't an agreement to agree about having a democracy or having a country called Ukraine at all, is there?
What about the geography? Because if you look at the maps of that area, you've got a kind of Ukraine sort of pokes away from Russia into some of these former Soviet countries, which are in Eastern Europe. What about the geography of it? Because we've got this whole area, the Russian Black Sea Fleet and the Crimea involved here as well.
Yeah. Well, as I say, the Crimea only became part of the Ukraine in 1954. So they've got a very strong case of the people down there saying, well, actually, we're part of Russia. But, of course, that's not accepted by the Tatar minority in the Ukraine. They want to stay part of the Crimea. They are pro-Kiev. So the potential, for example, for Russian and Tatar conflict inside the Ukraine is very definitely there. Can anybody hear Kosovo here? Can anybody hear Bosnia? These possibilities exist. And we're not talking. The thing about the Ukraine is it's still got nuclear weapons. This isn't like a Balkan country. And the Western powers and Russia will be drawn in to support their protégés if this is what happens. And of course, this is all taking place in the middle of a global economic crisis. So it won't just be the Ukraine where people will be killing each other. They're killing each other in Thailand, but we haven't been told about that on our TVs. That's a long way, a faraway country of which we know little. But similar conflicts are emerging all over the world. And of course, in Egypt, the Western-backed military dictatorship is busily killing the Muslim Brotherhood supporters who won the election. So it depends who wins the election, whether we support them or not, doesn't it?
Going back to the geography, I mean, you've got the Black Sea there, you've got Turkey below the Black Sea, you've got Ukraine above it. Really, the eastern half or two-thirds of Ukraine pokes straight into Russia, Martin, doesn't it? And actually, Kiev itself is not very far from Moscow.
No, well, I mean, it's a much further on that than it looks on your map there. Well, the point is that from the Russian point of view, think about Syria. They were able to play a very hardball game over Syria last year because they got the Black Sea Fleet was able to project Russian power into the Eastern Mediterranean, including sending their aircraft carrier missile destroyer, which was probably the game changer in terms of forcing the West to back off. But, of course, if this could be seen as the West's punishment to Putin for that, we are now going to provoke problems right in your face in Ukraine because we were so fed up with the way you frustrated us over Syria. And of course, this directly impacts upon Putin's capacity to intervene in Syria, because if the Ukraine keeps control of Crimea, they could decide to kick out the Black Sea Fleet and so on.
All the key things that happened to do with the takeover of the parliament in Kiev happened just as the Sochi Olympic Games were closing. I'm reminded of a few years ago, the Beijing Olympics, when the opening ceremony of that was used as an excuse at the time, while all the world's media were looking over at China, for there to be attacks in South Ossetia, South Ossetia, yeah. And Georgia. So, I mean, am I stretching a point to think that there may
You can
timing?
Imagine that the Russian general staff are thinking of it in these terms. Is this all spontaneous, or is it actually being orchestrated by Western intelligence services?
Just intervening for a second, Martin. 500 miles, roughly, it is between Kiev and Moscow. Now, that's not a long way in terms of this now being a centre for NATO.
Yes, but don't forget that Kiev was the original basis of the Russian state. Moscow only became the capital of Russia long after Kiev. So there's a very strong kind of emotional commitment to keeping Kiev in Russia, very similar to the Serbian belief that Kosovo belonged to them because it used to belong to them, and their famous battle of Kosovopoli against the Turks where they were defeated was there. But of course, in modern times, Kosovo became a majority Muslim area. But of course, if we start talking about which parts of Ukraine have got majorities of what, then we're already on the slippery slope to Bosnia on steroids.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour that the democratically elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was overthrown, has been jailed, and is now facing a death sentence. We also now have the situation with Yanukovych. I mean, he managed to scoot out of the country. He's over in Russia now. But certainly, you know, he is going to be arrested if he's back in the western part of Ukraine. There's also another connection, isn't there, between these two conflicts? I mean, both democratically elected leaders, both overthrown, both criminalised by the new regime. And there is another connection, and that is that There was an article on the Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, which showed two leaflets which were distributed in the last couple of weeks. One leaflet was in the last couple of weeks in Kiev, which was identical, although it had Ukrainian script on it, Ukrainian writing, identical to another leaflet which was distributed in Egypt a couple of years ago, or actually, no, last year, beginning of last year, when Morsi was overthrown. So, I mean, is this really just a bit of photocopying job going on here? Or do you think that there's actually some sort of deliberate program behind the scenes to overthrow these democratic governments?
Well, there's a deliberate program to overthrow governments which don't do what the West wants, democratic or otherwise. And a key player in all of this is an organisation called Canvas, C-A-N-V-A-S, that used to be called Otpor. And they are based in Belgrade. And they are basically,
okay, CANVAS stands for the Centre for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies.
Yeah, and they originally, they grew out of Otpor. Otpor are very definitely funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and other US government agencies. And what the Western intelligence services have been developing over the last few years is what I call their 1968 department. So they overthrow governments by getting students into the street, getting them beaten up by the police, getting the police to overreact, and then you can push governments out. So Milosevic was pushed out by that kind of tactic in Serbia, and similarly with Morsi in Egypt. Now, of course, the Russians are not entirely innocent of this. They support their protégés as well. But, of course, the danger with everybody supporting their protégés in these very, very 50-50 situations is that democracy as a whole is undermined. If people can see that the only way to get your way, whatever side you're on, is to get into the street, start demonstrating, and if necessary, kill policemen, because there's no doubt about it, the demonstrators in Kiev did kill policemen, whether that's okay or not. I mean, you might say it's justified, you might not, but it certainly happened. And if you compare this with what went on in Northern Ireland for many years, is that there was an understanding on both sides that after Bloody Sunday, that live ammunition was not to be used in street confrontations. So you'd often get fights and struggles and Molotov cocktails and rubber bullets being used, but neither side would bring firearms to the table. But of course, what's happened in Kiev, well, it seems that we'll have to go back over it. It looks as if the demonstrators open fire on the police then retaliate, and this is all part of the Otpor playbook. Yeah,
but this is
very similar to what happened in Syria, where what were essentially peaceful demonstrations collapse into chaos, and then of course you've got an armed rebellion on.
So how is the National Endowment for Democracy, how can something, an organisation that's promoting democracy, be involved in something which is so anti-democratic as to overthrow a democratically elected president who was only elected about a year ago?
Well, the Russians
and also was agreeing to more democratic elections in the very near future.
Well, what the problem from a Russian point of view is you arrogate to yourselves in the West the right to promote democracy at government expense, so British taxpayer money will be spent on helping demonstrators in countries like Ukraine and Syria. But if the Russians, for example, were to pay activists in Britain to go round stirring things up, the British might be not very happy about it. But the West goes around basically supposedly spreading democracy, but basically pushing their agenda at taxpayer expense in other people's countries. And, you know, inevitably the Russians take a dim view of it. From their point of view, this is a vital national interest for us, and we can't afford to let you push us around. I hope they're not going to overreact. The most sensible thing for them to do is just to try and take the heat out of the situation. And of course, they do have leverage over Ukraine, because Ukraine owes Russia a load of money. So the Russians could just say, well, either pay us your money now, or we'll cut off your gas supply. But of course, if they cut off the gas supply to the Ukraine, that means that the gas supply to Western Europe is cut off. So Western Europe is dependent on Russian gas. So the Russians could start to play hardball here and say, right, well, we're not going to sell our gas to you at less than world market prices. I mean, this is a lot of what this was about, is that they were saying to the Ukraine, well, if you want to do things we don't like, because you're our friends and neighbours, we're prepared to sell you your gas at way below the market price. But if you're going to be a nuisance and make trouble for us, then you must pay us the market price, which you can't afford, so we're just going to switch off your gas supply. But of course, from the Russian point of view, that's a bit problematic, because it means cutting off their German customers who pay perfectly well, and they're not that keen to do that. So hopefully, because all these interests are involved, everybody will get sensible and negotiate. But the potential for this to go the wrong way is very definitely there. And it seems to me that many Western politicians, like John McCain, who is over there encouraging the far-right demonstrators to have a go at the police, they are playing with fire. Because ultimately this could blow up and we'll all be the losers.
Martin, there is another dimension to this, which is the religious dimension. Jewish synagogues and Eastern Orthodox Christian churches have been and are being attacked now in the West.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians, as I say, the Ukrainian far right were in alliance with the Nazis. So, for example, it was the Ukrainian SS that finished off the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, the Warsaw Uprising in Poland. So you can see that for many Russians, they see the Ukrainian nationalists as extremely problematic because they've got a track record of being pro-Nazi. Now, that's not to say that all Ukrainian nationalists are pro-Nazi. That's an exaggeration. But there is very definitely a far-right extremist element involved in the Ukraine, a bit like the sort of Ulster Defence Association or the Ulster Volunteer Force, for example.
Okay, you mentioned Ireland there, and there's been quite a lot of discussion about that this week too. So we'll leave Ukraine for the time being and move to Ireland. What about the Hyde Park bombings in the 1980s and this chap Duffy, who's been now told there will be no prosecution? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as Martin McGuinness said yesterday, I don't know anybody's surprised about this. Surely everybody knew that a deal had been done, that the peace process was going to be... I mean, it was basically linked to the IRA's weapons handover. They agreed to hand over their weapons on the understanding, A, that their prisoners would be released, and B, that those who were on the run would be basically allowed to go. And that was part of the deal. And the leadership of Sinn Féin sold the deal to the IRA foot soldiers, if you like, on the basis that what they were going to get out of it was that they could then go, you know, they could go back to living in peace as civilians. And this chap that was going to be prosecuted is reputedly a very strong supporter of the peace process. And that's, of course, if you want people like that to support the peace process, there's a quid pro quo.
So why was he arrested then?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because I think there was some file left over, or some warrant that hadn't been cleared up. But what really fascinates me about this is that he was arrested the same day as Woolwich, and it turns out that he's going to be they agreed not to prosecute him the same day as the Woolwich bombers, the Woolwich murderers, whatever
Lee
they
Rigby's
are,
were
the Rigby, Lee Rigby's murderers were put on trial. So there's an obvious kind of disjunction going on here. I mean, the IRA chap killed four British soldiers, and he's not going to be prosecuted. And
well, we don't know it was him for a start.
Well, no, we don't. We don't, that's fair
Nobody
enough.
Knows.
But I mean, the point is, what I wonder is the timing here. The timing here, because why are these two cases, which have got nothing to do with each other, over many decades apart, why is it that the same day as Woolwich, this chap is arrested, and the same day as it's agreed that he's not going to be prosecuted, the Woolwich two are sentenced? Now, it may just be coincidence, but you've got to remember that the way I'm thinking, well, which intelligence services is pulling the strings here, and what kind of effect are they hoping to create? And that would be as true of what goes on in Ireland as it is of what goes on in Ukraine or Syria. Things are not what they seem. That doesn't mean I know what's happening, I don't. But don't presume you know either.
Now, what possible motive could there be for connecting the two? One is a so-called IRA terrorist suspect. The others are now convicted Islamists, terrorists, murderers.
Yes, but at the same time, it was also killing of British soldiers in London. Well, I mean, the fact is, the question is, what element of false flag may or may not be going on here? Now, I'm not accusing... I've thought quite deeply about what went on at Woolwich. They definitely did have contact with the security services, so there is a question mark over who these chaps are and how they ended up where they are. I mean, somebody put them up to what they did. The question is, who put them up to what they did? And if you look at the Boston bombing in the US, I think it's absolutely clear that the Sarnaev brothers, who have been blamed for it, are basically... were working with the intelligence services and were set up as patsies. Now, this could be the case with our two converts from Nigeria, who were not born Muslims, but ended up in a crazy situation doing crazy things because somebody had been feeding them a load of nonsense. The question is, who? Because we know for a fact that Western intelligence services do run Islamic terrorist groups. They're running them in Syria right now, as the Syrian government will tell you.
Now, the finger of blame has been pointed at the police service of Northern Ireland in the John Downey case, and we hear that there's going to be a judge-led inquiry into the IRA amnesty, they call it in inverted commas, in the Metro today, as the Hyde Park bombing suspect trial came to an end. So do you think this is going to put an end to it? It was a judge-led inquiry into how these letters were sent out to people who there are questions about whether they should have been sent to?
Well, as I said earlier, Martin McGuinness was saying that, you know, you knew that a deal had been done, and various loyalist politicians saying, but we didn't know they were going to send them letters. And they said, well, you didn't need to know. But the point is, yes, there were letters sent, but, you know, why is everybody getting excited about this? This has been on the... people have known that this is what the reality is for a long time. What Sinn Féin have been calling for all along is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where everybody comes forward and tells what they really did, including Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who used to run the Force Research Unit, responsible for directing the Loyalist Terror Campaign. Or the people who bombed Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, who the Irish police are pretty much convinced were British intelligence agents. Now, they must be living in retirement somewhere. Perhaps we should put everybody on trial, including perhaps Margaret Thatcher, although she's dead, because she may have given permission for various illegal activities when she was Prime Minister. If we really want to go back over it, let's go back over it. But it'll cut two ways, you can be sure of that.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.